Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone here at Erickson's Restaurant to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, and welcome to our TV audience as well. My name is Sylvia Campbell, and I'm your moderator for today. Our speaker is Roy Davidson of Pincher Creek, a lawyer who has an interest in the issue of Native reserves. And the order of the program today is Roy will speak, and then he will speak for 20 to 30 minutes. We'll have lunch, and at your table you may want to discuss the issues that he's raising. And the question period will follow after you have your lunch. I'd like to introduce Roy Davidson. The flyer had a fair bit of information about him. He was a lawyer born and raised in Lethbridge, who now lives in Pincher Creek. He has recently completed a novel on Blackfoot history, the first of a series. His interest in human rights has taken him to the Guatemala City dump, to the streets of Bolivia, and to Brockett. He has been a director of the NAPI Friendship Center and the Horse Spirit Youth Society. Would you join me in welcoming Roy Davidson?
Thank you, Sylvia. It's a great honor to be here and stand at a podium that people like Romeo Dallaire have stood at. I really enjoyed that session. There were a few more people than there are today. It's another great honor to be in Sven Erickson's, which is something that is going to, I guess, not be around much longer, I understand. And it's kind of neat to come back here because I was born and raised in Lethbridge, and I grew up right next door to Sven Erickson. So we knew him and his wife and his family very well. Kind of fun to be here. Anyway, the topic that I have really isn't a great lunch discussion, I guess, but here I am anyway. And I guess to start out, I'd simply like to tell you that there are things that I have learned, later on in my life, that I think it's important for people in the rest of Southern Alberta and the rest of the world to know. I wish to make known those things to you so that they will perhaps do things in your heart and in your life that they have begun to do in my life. I will say that I have 25 handouts, two different ones, that are over on the piano bench, and I don't know if Sylvia can make efforts to make other copies or whatever, but there's an awful lot of information on the internet on the things I propose to speak about. I guess the place to start for me is in 1492, and I grew up in the school system. Everybody knows 1492, and everybody knows Christopher Columbus. What I never understood, though, is that Christopher Columbus came back to the Caribbean in 1493, and he came back as, I don't know, governor or I'm not exactly sure what he was called, but he came with the blessing of the king and queen of Spain, came to Española, which is the island of the Dominican Republic and Haiti today, and there were about 6 million Taino indigenous people who resided on that island and the surrounding islands. And over the next very short number of years, 5 to 10 years, he slaughtered the best part of 6 million of them. The Spanish conquistadores that we read with great interest of them coming over and finding, for example, Florida and the Fountain of Youth, and going on to the gold mines and the silver mines of Peru and Bolivia, the indigenous people were there as slaves, and they were slaughtered by the millions, not just outright slaughter from being chased down on horseback and whacked with swords and stabbed with pikes and pregnant women cut open and babies slashed to bits and bashed to bits, but also they were enslaved in the traditional definition of slavery. I recently was in Bolivia and found out that in the silver mines in Bolivia, the indigenous people were sent into the mines, and it was cheaper for the Spanish simply to keep sending them in there rather than bring them out to feed them. So there were millions, well, I don't know how many millions, but there were many, many, many indigenous people who went into the mines as slaves and never came out of the hole in the ground. Some of the things that I found really shocking, and I apologize for this lunch discussion, but some of the things that I find outrageous are the sport of hunting indigenous people. You've all heard the expression, the dogs of war, and I never really understood that expression. We all use it, we've all heard it, but I find that what the dogs of war were dogs that were trained for war, and the Spaniards brought a bunch of them over, and they made sport of hunting indigenous people with these dogs, which are apparently fairly large dogs that were kept unfed and were turned loose to hunt indigenous people as the British hunt fox in England and things like that. I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail of that stuff. There's information that's out there, and I guess that's one of the things I'd like to convey to you, is that there is material that's out there on the internet in libraries that documents and describes these sorts of things. And these are the things that I never understood for many, many years. And consequently, I wondered about organizations which take on, for example, Columbus Day. There's a great organization in the United States that is trying to get rid of Columbus Day. Being Canadians, we're not real familiar with that. But the second, maybe somebody can help me, I think it's the second Monday or the second Friday in October is Columbus Day. And on that day, a number of Americans celebrate the arrival of Columbus in the New World. And I think most indigenous people lament what happened as the result of his arrival here. How this all impacts me is that in North America, there certainly was actions taken by Europeans, which I think amounts to genocide. I use that word. I'm kind of pleased to be able to use it because Colin Powell has used it. It's a word I don't think is used often enough and accurately enough by politicians. I've put my plug in here for Sudan, which I think there is a genocide taking place in Sudan. And the politicians are afraid to use that word because it means a tremendous expenditure in sending over troops and things like that to curb that. Colin Powell, who you all know, said that what's happening in Sudan truly is a genocide. And then all of a sudden he disappeared from the scene. I haven't seen him since. I'm sure he's there, but I don't know why he's not in the limelight like he used to be. In any event, it's my belief that actions taken primarily by the United States government against the indigenous peoples of North America, the Native Americans, amounts to genocide, and I use that word. That understanding has helped me to gain an understanding of my neighbors in Pincher Creek, the Piikani Nation, members of the Blackfoot tribe, the Niitsitapi, if you were to use their language. Probably to kind of make this some sense to you, I would read from instructions from George Washington, the first president of the United States, to Major General John Sullivan. He's sending him out to do some dirty work on Native Americans, and he says, "Sir, the expedition you are appointed to command is to be directed against the hostile tribes of the Six Nations of Indians, with their associates and adherents. The immediate objects are the total destruction and devastation of their settlements and the capture of as many prisoners of every age and sex as possible." And then he goes on to say, "It should be previously impressed upon the minds of the men, whenever they have an opportunity, to rush on with the war whoop and fixed bayonet. Nothing will disconcert and terrify the Indians more than this. But you will not, by any means, listen to any overture of peace before the total ruin of their settlements is effected." That's the first president of the United States. Teddy Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, was a president of the United States. And in his writings, he says, "The rude, fierce settler who drives the savage from the land lays all civilized mankind under a debt to him. American and Indian, Boer and Zulu, Cossack and Tartar, New Zealander and Maori, in each case the victor, horrible though his many of his deeds are, has laid deep the foundations of the future generations of a mighty people. He goes on to say, it is of incalculable importance that America pass out of the hands of their red Aboriginal owners and become the heritage of the dominant world races. These are statements that are made by presidents of the United States. Now, I had no idea that presidents made such statements. William Tecumseh Sherman was a Civil War general in the American Civil War. He and General Philip Sheridan, after the Civil War, came to the West to fight the Indian Wars. And that's the terminology that comes from the Americans. General William Sherman said in a letter to one of his people on September 23, 1868, "But the more we can kill this year, the less will have to be killed the next war. For the more I see of these Indians, the more convinced am I that they all have to be killed, or be maintained as a species of paupers." Those are statements that are made by representatives of the United States government, and I will extrapolate to say the Europeans who came to this country and settled it, it betrays an attitude of carelessness, at the very least, toward the indigenous people, and I would say, at the worst, an attitude of arrogant disregard. How does this affect us here in southern Alberta? How does this affect me? How it bore itself out in the West, not so much in Canada, and I think the Canadian government, to a certain extent, is to be commended for a certain level of restraint. I'll pick on the American example. There were a number of massacres that took place at the hands of the United States government. Now, to talk about those massacres, it's important to understand some of the history of the indigenous people, of the Plains Indians around here. I'm going to focus upon an event called the Baker Massacre or the Marias Massacre. It took place in 1870 down on the Marias River. But to understand what happened there, you need to understand that the Plains Indian culture, and particularly the Blackfoot culture, was one in which men went out to make war. Now, when I say make war, it's not make war to go out and stand in lines as the British and French did and fire at one another. Their making war was solely for the purpose of gaining honor for themselves as young warriors, as young people, in order to attain position, in order to attain any level of respect and honor within their community. It was very important for them to go out and gain honor. And they gained honor by doing things to their enemies. For the Blackfoot, their enemies were the Crows to the south, the Lakota to the southeast, the Assiniboine, the Crees, across the mountains, the Flatheads, and the Kootenai. And what they would do, and not just the Blackfoot to the Crows, for example, but the Crows as well to the Blackfoot, or the Crees to the Blackfoot, they would go on raids against their enemy. They would do their best to go into an enemy camp, take the best buffalo running horses from inside the camp where the best ones were kept, and get out without being detected, and go back and say, "Ha, look what I got." And that would gain honor for those people. As you can imagine, sometimes things go wrong, and there is a confrontation, and there is bloodshed. But seldom is there wholesale bloodshed, like we are led to believe in the Westerns and into some of the fictional literature and so on. Typically, the bloodshed would maybe be one or two people might end up getting shot. Bows and arrows were very ineffective at any great range. The early firearms that were brought into the country by the Europeans were very ineffective at any short range. And long range, just nothing happened. There was insults back and forth, and people would fire shots and so on, but very little damage was done. So in the context of that sort of gaining of honor, that's what most young Native men were bent on in the early 19th century, is gaining honor, gaining stature in the community through that method. If they ended up killing somebody, well, that helped. Great honor if you could go and strike your enemy and take his weapon and leave him alive, well, that was about as good as it gets. If you get that close to take his weapon and there's a little bit more than that and he gets killed, well, then that's okay too. But you need to understand that the mentality of these young men was to gain honor. And they would do that by stealing horses, by getting one-upmanship on the enemy. So in the late 1860s, a fellow by the name of Owlchild took some horses from a white rancher by the name of Malcolm Clark down in Montana. Malcolm Clark was incensed by that, as you can imagine he would be. But for Owlchild, hey, he was just doing what comes naturally. That's the way you do it. This is the way we do it here. So he took off with the horses. Malcolm got upset. Malcolm had a confrontation with Owlchild, and Owlchild got a whipping from Malcolm Clark. Now, that's strike number two, because now Owlchild is duty-bound to seek revenge. His honor has been impugned. And it's necessary for him then to do the only honorable thing within that culture, go out and kill Malcolm Clark, which he did, and injured his son Horace Clark. And that was the way it was done. Now, this is not in isolation. There have been all sorts of this stuff happening. There have been incursions into traditional Blackfoot territory now for the past 20 years, prior to that, 30 years. Where it started first with free trappers, free traders coming in. Traders came in, the American whiskey traders came in. Ultimately, Fort Benton was established. There were tremendous incursions upon the Blackfoot territory. Understand that the Blackfoot signed a treaty in 1855, which gave them a tremendous part of northern Montana. And over the next number of years, by executive order of the President of the United States government, that treaty was made smaller and smaller and smaller. A lot of tension between natives and whites. A lot of whites coming onto the reserve. News of gold on the reserve. News of gold in the mountains. And the territory of the Blackfoot was continually being infringed upon. And they didn't like that. The buffalo were disappearing. One of the things that the United States government did was particularly set about to exterminate the buffalo, thinking that if we get rid of the buffalo, we get rid of the natives. Anyway, that's more backdrop to what's going on, tension between the whites, and the native people. General Philip Sheridan from Civil War fame and William Tecumseh Sherman, said, we need to do something about this. The people of Montana said, we need to do something about this. And so General Sheridan said, quote, if the lives and property of citizens of Montana can best be protected by striking Mountain Chief's band, I want them struck. Tell Baker to strike them hard. Baker was Colonel Eugene Baker of the Baker Massacre. Mountain Chief is the band, the chief of the band to whom Owlchild belonged and was believed to be residing. So on the morning of, I believe it was January 23rd, 1870, accompanied by Joe Kipp, who was a white trader from Fort Benton area and for whose family Kipp, Alberta is named, by the way, accompanied Colonel Baker and Horace Clark, son of the deceased Malcolm Clark, to a place on the Marias River where they believed Mountain Chief's camp was located. They came over the top just before dawn, and they saw a camp down there, and they attacked it. Joe Kipp said, no, stop, stop, this is not Mountain Chief's band, this is Heavy Runner's band. No way was Baker going to stop. they went in and they annihilated 173 people, mostly women and children and old men, in a camp that was suffering from smallpox, where the warriors, the hunters, had left the camp to go out and find buffalo, which by 1870 were getting very scarce. So, in the end result, 173 innocent people died because the United States government decided that they needed to punish the Blackfoot. They wanted to get Owl Child. But I suggest to you that the evidence is, and it's out there, and you can read it as well as I can, the evidence is that before they completed their attack anyway, probably before they began their attack, they knew that Owl Child was not likely in that camp. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. And I suggest to you that it's acts of violence like that against a people who, at the beginning of the European discovery, sorry, I choke on that word. At the beginning of the European influence in the West here, the native people almost unanimously and almost without exception welcomed white people to their land. I'm going to suggest to you that the native people responded largely to acts of violence against them. And the acts of violence, as I've indicated, are small things where one or two or three people might get hurt or killed, horses get taken, and so on, and yet it's like the United States government comes along with a cannon where they could use the fly swatter. Statements by authorities in the United States who were careless as to whether or not smallpox could be carried to the land. Smallpox wiped out more natives than General Sherman did and General Custer did. There was discussion, and it's open to debate, I think at this point in time, whether smallpox was intentionally introduced among the natives, but that was discussed. In the 1300s in Europe, it was common practice to take diseased bodies and catapult them into a city that's under siege. And so it was certainly something that was in the knowledge of the Europeans as they came to the West. It's certainly something that was in the knowledge of the Spaniards when they were in the Caribbean, and smallpox and diseases unknown to them took humongous tolls. So the purpose, I guess, of my accepting this invitation to come to speak to you is to inform you and let you know that it's not as I was told. My experience, my education did not tell me this stuff. As I began to understand what the Blackfoot, who are the people that I've studied, endured, as I understood that, it gave me a new understanding. Let me just give you, end with just a bit of an example. In 1877, Treaty 7 was signed. And understand that Treaty 7 was a treaty that was brought to Native people by English-speaking white people to non-English-speaking Native people, and it was interpreted to them by a couple of Métis people by the name of Jimmy Jock Bird and probably our friend Jerry Pott. There is reasonable question in my mind that the terms of the treaty were accurately translated to the Native people. There is great doubt in my mind that people who had no concept of a square mile or an acre or ownership or a title, I have serious doubts as to whether they could effectively understand what they were signing, bearing in mind that the Native people were in the practice of forming treaties, forming peace pacts with their neighbors, from time to time with the Crow, from time to time with the Lakota, from time to time with the Tanaka across the mountains and so on. So that concept they were thoroughly familiar with. They knew full well that the Europeans were coming and coming in great numbers. And they were led to believe that this is going to be a good thing. You make peace with the whites and they'll feed you and stuff like that. I seriously doubt that they understood that what this meant is that they would no longer own the land because they didn't think they owned it in the first place. And they didn't think that the white people would own the land and exclude them from it. So with Treaty 7 in 1877, what happened is that the Piikani were, and the Kainai and the Siksika were placed on a reserve, and they were said, this is where you will live. You no longer make raids down to Montana. You no longer steal horses here and there. You will live there. We will provide for you. And oh, by the way, your children from 6 to 16 will go to our schools. And it's the law that they must go. So imagine the first class of little Blackfoot kids, little Blackfoot boys particularly, who had spent many, many nights around a fire listening to their fathers, their uncles, their grandfathers, their friends, talking about going on raids against the Tanaka, against the Crows, against the Crees, and so on, and aspiring to follow in their footsteps and be men like men are, and all of a sudden their parents are with the Mounted Police in some instances, the Indian agent as they were called, taking their kids to a school, where the first thing that happened to these little boys who had never seen a barber, their hair's cut off, and that's an insult, that's an offense. They are told that if they speak their language, they'll get a beating, and they speak their language and they did get a beating. They're told if they practice their faith, their religion, they'll get a beating, and they did get a beating. You take these kids and you put them in a school somewhere away from their parents, and they're not parented. Their parents back on the reserve don't have kids to parent. And so you have a whole culture, a whole society who lose the ability to parent. These kids are in the residential school. They come back to the reserve, because that's where they go when they come out of that. And they have kids that they don't know how to parent. The parents who are left on the reserve haven't parented their kids, so they don't know how to parent. And I'm going to suggest to you that today, one of the serious problems that we have, certainly at the Piikani Nation, is it's very difficult for kids to be raised. Because after many, many generations of this, and bear in mind that there were residential schools as late as the 60s, there is a real dearth of ability on the part of Aboriginal people to parent. And I don't mean to be offensive by that. I mean to say that when I raised my kids, I learned how to parent my kids by watching my parents. My wife had watched her parents. I'm certain that everybody here, I doubt there's many people that took a course on parenting. Now there are such courses. But parenting is something that you learn as you go along the way. So if you don't have that training, how do you raise your kids? What happens then? We all know the other evils of residential schools. We all know the other evils of alcohol abuse and drug abuse and horrible things and unemployment. And I'm going to suggest that Indian reserves are not a great place to raise families, to raise kids, to find jobs, to be contributing members of society. My understanding of Native tradition, Native history, Native background has given me this understanding that I will fight to the death somebody who says Native people who are a waste of skin. They are absolutely not. They are a people who have suffered a tremendous amount under the thumb of the Europeans who came to North America. I've given you some examples of those things. I would invite you and I would encourage you to please read the stuff that's out there, and it is not hard to find. And understand that these people are not unreasonable in their claims of saying, we were mistreated. My closing comment is that Elijah Harper, and Elijah Harper, we all probably remember who Elijah Harper was. Elijah Harper is a Native American who stood in the way of the Meech Lake Accord, and with an eagle feather in his hand, he stood quietly before the group who wanted his assent to it, and he said no. Anyway, Elijah Harper said recently, and it was in the Lethbridge Herald, and you might have read it, he called upon the Canadian government, and I call upon the Canadian government I don't think my voice is nearly as credible as Elijah Harper's, but I call upon the Canadian government, Prime Minister Harper, to say yes to the Native people. We did some things that were not the best things. We do have some fault. We do have some blame as a government, and we're sorry. The Germans, after the Second World War, eventually came along and said, we're sorry. These things happened, and we're sorry that they happened. I don't feel, as a 21st century North American, European descent, white person, I don't feel that I, Roy Davidson, have much to say I'm sorry about to Native people. But insofar as I represent what they were, what the Europeans were, back in the 19th century and the 18th, 16th, back to the 13th century, I think that I have a certain responsibility as a white person, as a newcomer to this land, or the descendant of a newcomer, that I wish things had been different. And I do, to the extent that I can possibly apologize, I do apologize to the Native people who I think were terribly abused, wrongly maligned, and have, in spite of that, have survived. Thank you.
We'll break now for lunch. The cost of the program, which includes lunch, is $8. Would someone at each table collect it, and it will make sure that it's the right amount for the number of people at your table?